Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Monday, February 17th, 2020. Present today, we've got Representative Knopp, Representative LeBond and Representative Knopp, and Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Johnston, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And I don't see any legislators in the audience there. If folks could just double check your cell phones. And at this meeting, the committee will be adopting a committee substitute for HB 205, which is the FY21 operating budget, and HB 206, which is the FY21 mental health budget. And then we will begin hearing subcommittee closeout reports. The committee substitutes that we will adopt today are the governor's proposed FY21 budgets. The only changes made in these committee substitutes are technical and structural changes made by the Legislative Finance Division and Legislative Legal. And after the adoption of both subcommittee, both committee substitutes, we will have a presentation from Legislative Finance on the changes that were made. So with that, do I have a motion on the committee substitute for HB 205? And we've also been joined by Representative Wolf. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move that the House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 205, Work Draft 31-GH2197-M, Bruce, dated 1/24/20, as our working document.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Seeing no objection, we have adopted the committee substitute as our working document for House Bill 205. Do I have a motion on the committee substitute for HB 206?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, I move that House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 206, Work Draft 31-GH2198-M, Bruce, dated 1/22/20, as our working document.
And thank you. Seeing no objection, we have adopted the committee substitute as our working draft for House Bill 206. So here to walk the committee through the committee substitute changes is Alexi Painter, Legislative Fiscal Analyst. And Mr. Painter, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. So I will start with House Bill 205. And again, these are, I will walk through the changes. Again, these are all technical and conforming changes made to bring the bill to the legislative drafting manual instead of the way the governor presents the bill. So I think in front of you, you also have a document that lists out the major changes. First change is in the title of the bill. The words supplemental appropriations were added to the title because there is a supplemental in this bill. The next change is on page 2, and that is to the lead-in text to section 1. And this is standard lead-in language that the legislature adds each year. The last sentence is the new sentence. It says, a department-wide, agency-wide, or branch-wide unallocated reduction set out in this section may be allocated among the appropriations made in this section to that department, agency, or branch. And the same change was made in House Bill 206 as well. I'll try to not go too fast, but the next one is all the way on page 50. So page 50, starting on line 21, these sections have been reordered so that the royalty deposits to the permanent fund go first and then the percent of market value draw. The other change is in section C. The governor's bill had the wording that gave the amount of the full percent of market value draw as reduced by the other section. This switches it to show just the net amount in the language rather than the full draw. And that's just a, I suppose, a change for flow and to make that number clearer. Next change is on page 57, section 19E. And so this starts on line 7. This section has been reworded to simplify it from the way the governor had it. In previous years, this section included debt issued by other agencies, not just the University of Alaska. And so it was a little bit of a lengthier section. The governor only submitted the University of Alaska portion, and so the formatting that was in there in previous years is unnecessary. This just simplifies that formatting. The next change is on page 65.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Mr. Painter?
Pause.
Mr. Painter?
Okay, so the next item is on page 65, section 21W. And this begins on line 10. The fiscal year 21 was added to this language to clarify that the receipts in question were from fiscal year 21. And so the next change, I think I have the wrong page in the document in front of you, so it's actually page 67. This is section 22L. And the words unexpended and obligated and unobligated were added so that the section reads the unexpended and unobligated balance of the large passenger vessel gaming gambling tax account. And that's a change that's made to clarify to that the this appropriation does not affect any outstanding appropriations from the fund. It's only the unobligated balance that could be transferred. Second for everybody to catch up. So the next change is on page 71, line 18. And this change is a technical change to change calendar year 2020 to calendar year 2019. That was a drafting error in the governor's bill. The revenue distributed is for the previous cruising year, so this just changes to conform to that statute. And then the final change in this bill is on page 72, section 28, the lapse of appropriations, and this just updates the references to reflect the reordering that was done in section 8. And so that is all of the changes in this section. Or in this bill, there are other very minor ones where a few words were moved from one place to another, but these are all the major changes.
Thank you, Mr. Painter. Are there any questions on the operating budget, HB 205, before we move over to the mental health budget? Representative Knopp?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question, but it's not related to the proposed changes. Do we want to talk about that now while we have 205 in front of us, or we want to address 205 at a later date?
It's a substantive question regarding HB 205. Is
you know, it's just a question that's been on my mind, and I'm just staring here looking at it, and I'll just ask it, and if you want to take it up later, just let me know.
Our way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, on page 65, the line 7 through 10, the AGDC money, is that, I'm trying to remember what we did a year ago, was that $30 million in receipt authority that we give them? And are we just transferring receipt authority? This LNG project is a liquefied natural gas project. It's a completely separate project in AK LNG. Is that correct?
Representative Knopf, through the chair, I'm not really prepared to speak about this section. We can get back to you about that.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Ortiz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to page 67. Line 19, could you give me just a little bit more detail of the impact of that? I understand that we changed the date from 2021 to 2019, I think. Clarify that, and then just tell me about where these monies come from and where they go specifically, and whether that's standard practice.
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, the change in the date was actually a different section. This one, the change was to add the unexpended non-obligated balance.
That's right.
So this item is the transfer of the large passenger vessel gaming and gambling tax account to the capital income fund. That is a UGF tax, and it is being transferred in the governor's bill to the capital income fund. And that has happened some years, other years it has gone to other places, but that it's a UGF tax, so it can be spent for any purpose.
Follow up. And from your recollection, can you tell me some of the other places that it's gone in previous years?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I believe last year it went to the general fund in FY20, and FY19, I believe it also went to the capital income fund, but I can give you a longer history of where that fund's gone.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
The chair, could you explain what the supplemental appropriation is that we'd find in HB 205?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Josephson. That is item 10H, and let me pull up the page. That is on page 53. So the supplemental item is the appropriation of $2.8 million from the Capstone Avionics Revolving Loan Fund to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development for the Alaska Development Team. And that's a multi-year supplemental covering the years FY20 through 23. And because the fund itself lapses on June 30th, in order to use those receipts, the date must be an FY20 effective date.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions on HB 205? Seeing none, Mr. Painter on HB 206, the mental health budget.
Okay, turning over to House Bill 206, as in HB 205, the lead-in text on page 2 was amended to add the language about the unallocated reductions. The only other change is that on page 10, the governor's budget omitted the second fund roll-up, as it's called, showing where the statewide funding comes from. So when the Legislative Finance Division ran the numbers section, we added that roll-up in, and that changes the subsequent numbering of sections. There are no other changes in this bill.
Any questions on HB 206? Seeing no questions, thank you very much, Mr. Painter. So with that, we'll move over into the subcommittee closeout reports. And it's my hope to go through the subcommittee reports grouped together by the chair of the subcommittee. And I expect we will spend about 10 minutes on each subcommittee. We'll begin with the closeout report for the Department of Administration. And I'd like to invite Representative Johnston's staff, Robert Irvine, as well as Alexi Painter, Legislative Fiscal Analyst, to the table. And if you could put yourselves on the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman Foster and the Finance Committee. My name is Robert Irvin.
And Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division.
As aide to the subcommittee, I'm going to provide the following summary of the subcommittee's work. The subcommittee held a total of 6 meetings. During the meetings, discussions revolved around future savings to be realized by the consolidation of services, savings related to changes with employee and retiree health care, the challenges of recruitment and retention within the legal and advocacy services component, and an update from the commissioner on public media and rural service issues, as well as a response from a public media representative. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Administration submits the following recommendations for the fiscal year of 2021. Unrestricted general fund, $67,400,700. Designated general fund, $26,075,400. Other funds, $265,003,900. Federal funds, $1,104,700, for a total budget of 359,000. $584,700. Unrestricted general fund in the subcommittee's recommendation is $5,013,200 above the fiscal year 21 adjusted base and $1,372,700 above the FY21 governor's request. The majority of the UGF increases are the result of the use of PCE funds to fund HB 49 fiscal notes during the 2019 legislative session. This year, UGF will be used to fund the items included in the HB 49 fiscal notes. The governor's FY21 budget proposed a total of 28 changes from the FY21 adjusted base budget. After learning about each item, the subcommittee adopted all 28 changes with unanimous consent. Some of the highlights of these items: increases to pay for attorneys' bar dues for recruitment and retention purposes, a funding mechanism change for the Office of Public Advocacy and Public Defender budgets to use UGF instead of the power cost equalization funds used in the previous year, an increase of $1,235,000 and 10 new positions for the Office of Public Advocacy, additional travel resources for the Office of Public Advocacy and Public Defender, and reductions across multiple budget components to realize savings as a result of Office of Information Technology and Shared Services of Alaska consolidation. The subcommittee also considered three amendments. Due to ongoing conversations between the department and public media officials about the needs of Alaska's public broadcasting community, the subcommittee allocated only $1 million for public broadcasting radio grants. The subcommittee also added $372,700 to fully fund the request of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and fix an over-appropriation of boat receipts. Thanks, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, do we have any questions for Department of Administration? Representative Josephson?
The Chair, could you explain the last sentence? Subcommittee added funds to fully meet the demands of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. What is it that they requested?
So they were, through the Chair, they requested about $138,000 from the top of my head of MTAR funds from the trust, and then they asked for $372,000 of general fund from the state as a match for their skin in the game, the $138,000.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Wool?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the Chair, increase to pay for attorneys' bar dues for recruitment and retention purposes. Can you tell me how much that is, say, per individual and per department for the total?
Through the Chair, it is, I think, about $600 per attorney. And with just 1 second, I can tell you.
Is that $600 per year fee, generally?
Through the Chair, it is my understanding it's a yearly fee. For the Office of Administrative Hearings, it's $1,700. In the Commissioner's Office, it's $6,300. $3,500 in Labor Relations. It looks like $38,000 in the Office of Public Advocacy and about $66,000 in the Public Defender Agency.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the line that talked about the amendments allocated only $1 million for public broadcasting grants, then it indicates that there must have been some discussion about a considerably higher amount. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, the past appropriation for public broadcasting, not including the satellite infrastructure, has been about $2.7 million. And so the committee decided to do $1 million for the radio portion of those grants.
Follow-up? And in your discussions with the folks from Alaska Public Broadcasting community, was there discussion about the impact on the overall group of people not receiving the 2.7 million, because that was my understanding that was vetoed, and we appropriated it, the last legislature appropriated it, but then it was vetoed.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear some statements about the impact of not having access to those resources?
Representative Johnston?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we actually had some very robust conversations about this, and it wasn't until probably the last conversation we had with the advocating agency, which is API, is that what it is?
Alaska Public Broadcasting Incorporated.
Yeah. There were instances where it would show that, you know, a station might have lost an engineer or, you know, they've had to cut back here. But what I'd been looking for was actually an Excel sheet explaining what was done to each station. And to be honest, we never really got this. And I did spend time with many people in the industry. But it seems for health and safety, I think that we can make a good case for radio as the form that is used for health and safety, even though that the state has kept their own system to warn of fires, et cetera. But public radio has the better outreach. And so that's how we came to that $1 million. And it still brings us above the governor's budget, but hopefully it is going to be seen for what it is as far as keeping radios alive and being part of a public safety structure. So it maybe it will stay in the governor's budget.
Thank you for that explanation, Madam Co-Chair. Do we have the assurance that that spreadsheet that you were looking for is going to arrive at some point?
Actually, Representative Ortiz, no, I have not. The concern was that the Broadcasting Commission has not met. And so maybe that would have been where, maybe that would have been the place where we could have gotten something like that. But no, there hasn't been an overall spreadsheet to show the impact. I can safely say that there's been statewide impact with the cuts of these funds, but I can't tell you exactly how it's affected each station.
Thank you for that. Thank you.
Representative Knoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Irving, I haven't looked at all at the administration's budget, and so I'm just wondering, was there any discussions in the consolidation of the IT department and outsourcing to contracts in that budgeting process?
Mr. Irvine?
Through the chair, there were a lot of conversations about what's been going on with consolidation kind of historically over the last 5 years, and also the strategy going forward.
Follow up briefly. And then, so I'm understanding there was a $15 million contract signed with cloud for cloud computing services recently. Is that part of the discussion, and how did that affect transfers of money?
Representative Johnston?
Thank you, through the chair. You actually, Representative Knopp, have two different questions there. As far as the IT sharing, that this department has now hired a company to come in and help them structure it. It seemed to have been not going forward in the most organized and effective way for the last couple of years, and this was the one chance to sort of get it set straight. And I have to say, again, we had some pretty robust conversations in our subcommittee about what they were doing and how they were doing it, and I felt much better that I thought we can now get there, and it could be a cost savings for the state, and we will, at the end of the day, need fewer people. As far as going to the cloud, we also discussed that, and that's a different subject completely. And there are some, it's being further researched, but it seems that we could have a lot of cost savings by going to the cloud as opposed to using our own servers, both in time, efforts, and keeping the servers up and running.
Follow up. Thank you for that. So I just, a recent email I received, I wasn't very familiar with it, but it appears like there was a three-year contract signed with Microsoft for $15 million. And I'm wondering, did we displace any people? Where did we get, is this coming out operational ends at this point? So no savings recognized yet.
Actually, Mr. Irvin, the department did have cost savings throughout their budget. As they have digitalized, they have not had to replace employees, so there has been some cost savings. But this is in the future, and there is, I would hate to give the figure that they gave us for cost savings because it's still the devil's in the details. But
okay. Thank you.
But Mr. Irving might.
Through the chair, there's a reduction associate of 10 positions in the budget this year. And from memory, I think they're anticipating maybe $20 million a year going forward, but I don't want to,
right.
Don't quote me on that. And Mr. Painter might have something to add.
Mr. Painter?
Representative Knopf, through the chair, there was a letter that in response to legislative intent from the department that outlines the anticipated cost savings through a number of IT initiatives, and we can make sure you have a copy of that because it has a number of items, including the cloud.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you very much, Mr. Irvin. And I'd like to invite up Representative Johnston staff Aaron Shine and Kelly Cunningham, legislative fiscal analyst, up to the table to walk the committee through the Department of Health and Social Services subcommittee's report. And if you could both put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Aaron Shine, and I'm staff to Representative Johnston.
Kelly Cunningham, legislative finance.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Health and Social Services held 9 meetings to review the division's programs and budget requests and conclude our business and closeout meetings. The recommended budget from the subcommittee is from unrestricted general fund dollars is $1,109,740,800. For designated general funds, it's $86,436,800. For other funds, $167,710,600. And for federal funds, it's $2,065,065,500. That is a total budget of $3,428,952,700. To use those numbers as a compare and contrast, I used a couple different benchmarks, one being the management plan from fiscal year 15, the adjusted base for fiscal year 21, as well as the governor's 21 request. Compared to the 15 management plan, there is a reduction of $141,638,400, or about 11.3% decrease in unrestricted general fund spend. In contrast, there's $811,759,800 increase to federal funds. Using the adjusted base for fiscal year 21, the unrestricted general fund budget grew by $137,753,300, which is about a 14% increase in unrestricted general fund dollars. And federal is about $157,034,600, or about an 8% increase in federal dollars. Comparing to the governor's fiscal year 21 budget request, the unrestricted general fund dollars is increased by $7,416,600. However, that's offset by a $7,100 reduction in designated general fund. So the total general fund increase from the governor's budget is a total of $316,000. Mr. Chairman, the narrative report is outlined or is kind of walked through in four different sections, and through those I'll kind of go over the highlights if I can. So on page two of the narrative outlines all of the items that were approved as requested by the governor. There are 42 budget action items, 37 of them were adopted by the committee. Most of them were fund source changes, which was a net zero change to the overall budget. There were some out-year fiscal notes of legislation that was passed in previous legislative years. But some of the highlights are that there was an increase to general funds for the Pioneer Homes Payment Assistance Program. There was increased federal authority for frontline social workers in children's services. It restored the adult public assistance maintenance of EFRS requirements. And for public health, the subcommittee is recommending that you accept the transfer of parents as teachers to public health, women, children, and family health. On page three of the narrative report, you'll see there's another section, and this is the governor's items approved with modifications. For behavior health, there was a suggestion or a budget action item that the governor put forward to reduce the behavioral health treatment and recovery grants of the unrestricted general fund, but offsetting that with marijuana education treatment funding. That was for $11.4 million. After deliberation in the subcommittee felt that that was not a sustainable amount going forward. With the information we received from the Department and Office of Management and Budget, the subcommittee settled on a $4.3 million fund source change for that. So going forward, $4.3 million is set into the base for behavioral health treatment recovery grants. And that $7.1 million is what I kind of talked about at the beginning of my overview, why that designated general fund and the unrestricted general fund switch was done. There was also another budget item that the governor had proposed to reduce the restorative justice funding for the behavioral health treatment recovery grants. There was no offsetting unrestricted general fund, so to keep the grants held harmless, the subcommittee appropriated $70,000 to offset that reduction for restorative justice funding. The other item in public health, if you remember when we heard this committee, when you heard from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, there were some items that did not have the associated unrestricted general fund, general fund mental health match. The subcommittee did add general fund mental health for two of those items, one of them being the emergency programs comprehensive program planning coordinator. The final budget action item that the subcommittee amended from the governor's request was that the Office of the Commissioner had requested four additional positions. Those included a deputy commissioner, a project coordinator, a program coordinator, and a special assistant to the commissioner. The subcommittee is recommending that the only position to be included into the budget would be for the special assistant and the associated general fund and federal funds that are associated with that. The next section are the items that the subcommittee does not recommend approving for the governor's items. That was only one, and that was due to the state not receiving the award of the grant from the federal government for the preschool development grant. So those, we were not awarded it, so it's not necessary for us to increase the budget for that line item. Finally, Mr. Chairman, for additions and deletions, the subcommittee considered six amendments, four of which are outlined and were adopted. The first was to restore the suicide prevention grants that were zeroed out in a fiscal year or fiscal note last year during its reauthorization bill. It also removed the recidivism reduction funding from the Pioneer Home and the Pioneer Home Payment Assistance Program through the conversations with the Pioneer Home. As that line item was brought up, some of the subcommittee members didn't feel that the recidivism reduction funding was appropriate use in the Pioneer Homes, and so with that, the funding was removed and offset and put into the unrestricted general fund was put in to offset that reduction in the Pioneer Home. However, the recidivism reduction funding was then transferred to the behavior health treatment and recovery grants that I highlighted earlier. So that was pretty much a shuffle of all the money between those three allocations, and was a net effect on the budget. And then there was one amendment that inserted intent for the department to analyze individuals on the intellectual and developmental disabilities waiver list. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Hey, do we have any questions regarding Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Ms. Shine, on the last item, what is it that we think we're going to learn relative to the wait list? I thought there was a general agreement on those that got served and who got unserved in terms of the numbers.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there are many individuals on the wait list for the IDD waiver. I think that while the department does submit a report yearly on the wait list to give a kind of a progress report, the subcommittee is asking in this intent language to take a look at the individuals that are on the wait list and are not being served through the waiver to see if they're, I think that the two was if there is potentially 100% federally funded and the other was economic ability of them to pay for services, otherwise not if they didn't receive the services through the waiver.
Follow up.
My other question is about behavioral health. So last year, I'm going to guess that the FY19 budget was around $12 million, and we funded an FY20 $6 million with the hope of doing the 11-15 waiver on the other six. So I'm going to assume there's some missing unmet need. Did the subcommittee talk about that at all?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there was conversation about the reduction of the behavioral health treatment recovery grants from last year and the implementation of the 11-15 through the department. The department came to us with information stating that many individuals that previously weren't able to bill Medicaid services are now enrolled providers in Medicaid and are billing services, and therefore that need is being met. For the reduction in behavioral health treatment and recovery grants, I don't believe that there were many gaps that were shown in the services that were provided. The budget this year does not, or the budget that's being provided to you as a recommendation is not envisioning any sort of reduction in behavioral health treatment grants from last year to this year.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Shine, there's obviously a lot that has to be kept track of under the Health and Human Services budget, so not expecting a specific answer at this point to my question, but under the category of senior and disability services, it's my understanding that within that falls funding for what we call dayhab services. And can you tell me from the FY19 budget to now, has dayhab services received a significant reduction in financial support?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I do not believe so. Dayhab services were not part of the purview, actually, of last year's budget subcommittee nor this year's. I do know that through regulation, the department has limited the hours or capped the hours for dayhab services, and I think that they're out for comment on some clarification on those services right now. But the funding specifically for that service or waiver was not something that we talked about in the subcommittee, nor do I know that there is a corresponding reduction in the budget. But I will look into it and get back to you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Shine, the four positions requested by the department to the commissioner's office, looks like one of them, the special assistant to the commissioner, was accepted. Three of them were rejected. Can you speak to those? And were any of those the OCS position that was mentioned affiliated with a certain retired representative from North Pole?
Through the chair, Representative Wall. Yes, this is the department had a vision of putting all child services into one under one deputy commissioner, so it was OCS and juvenile justice. And as we dug further, and not that we didn't think it was a good idea, but we didn't feel it was fully vetted yet. And to give four high-level positions to a struggling agency didn't really seem appropriate at the time. And so this was my amendment. I feel that they should continue to work on it, and that's why we gave them a special assistant. But you have You have a special assistant with this position. You also have a position in the commissioner's office that is going to be looking into OCS that a former representative now holds. So you've got it coming from two different areas, and I think before you start restructuring the departments, maybe you should, you know, get a full grip on the concerns and where the funding and where the manpower should be going.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Shine. Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. We'll now move over to the Department of Transportation, and I'd like to invite up my Chief of Staff, Paul LeBol, come up to the table, and also Mr. Painter, Alexi Painter. And if you could both put yourselves on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul LeBol, Staff to Representative Foster.
Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Department of Transportation Subcommittee closed out with the following totals. Unrestricted General Fund, $157.2 million. Designated General Funds, $106 million. Other Funds, $355.9 million. Federal Funds, $1.6 million. For a total of $620.7 million. We reviewed the FY21 budget request and recommend the following actions. Accept 24 of the 26 governor's request. Most of these items were technical and either deleted hollow authority or made other non-UGF adjustments. The items affecting UGF were a $55,000 fund source change from UGF to Whittier Tunnel receipts, $500,000 in fund source changes from UGF to airport receipts, and $3.3 million UGF to add 8.8 weeks of service to the Alaska Marine Highway System. The subcommittee also recommended an additional $11.3 million for the Alaska Marine Highway System in UGF to further restore service. This was a member amendment and was based on a scenario provided to the subcommittee by the department. Because of this change and based on the recommendation of the department, the subcommittee denied $832,000 in reductions to administration and support. These were marine highway funds, and because of the increased activity in the marine highway with the additional spending approved by the subcommittee, the department said that more work will be required by administration and support, and because of the increased activity, more marine highway funds will be generated and will be available to the department. Finally, the subcommittee restored non-UGF travel reductions from FY20. The department testified that approximately $900,000 was transferred from other components to meet mission critical travel. This action should allow more of those funds to remain in their budgeted components and represents a zero increase in UGF spending. And with that, I'm available for questions.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, and maybe I'm missing something, but is $1.6 million in federal funding low for DOT? And I know that a lot of things they're paying 90% of various projects, and yes, maybe I'm missing something here.
Mr. LeBol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The majority, vast majority of federal funds going to DOT come in through the capital budget, and there's very little in the operating.
I knew I was missing something. Thanks.
Any further questions? Seeing no questions, thank you very much, Mr. Painter and Mr. LeBol. So next we'll move over to the Office of the Governor's Subcommittee Report, and I'd like to invite up my staff, Ryan Johnston and Kelly Cunningham, Legislative Fiscal Analyst. And if you could both put yourselves on the record. Maybe if we could just give everyone a moment to find their committee report.
Governor.
And I think we're about ready, so it's the last page of your packets for Office of the Governor, and if you could both put yourselves on the record.
For the record, Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Neil Foster.
For the record, Kelly Cunningham, Legislative Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. The House Finance Subcommittee for the Office of the Governor has submitted the following recommended operating budget for the FY20 Office of the Governor. By fund source, it's $21,969,000 in UGF, zero in DGF, $4,021,000 other funds, and $229,000 of federal funds, for a grand total of $26,219,000. The unrestricted general fund difference for the FY21 adjusted base to the House Subcommittee's budget recommendation is a reduction of $125,000 in UGF funds, which represents a 0.5% below the adjusted base. Positions-wise, there are 150 full-time positions in the Office of the Governor with zero part-time positions and 23 temporary positions for a grand total of 173 positions. The subcommittee reviewed the FY21 Governor's budget request and recommends that that budget be accepted with two changes from the FY20 budget. The first being a transfer of international trade support to the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, which is a UGF decrement of $125,000. And then the second being reduced authority in the Office of Management and Budget to align with the anticipated revenues and expenditures, which is a $150,000 decrement of interagency receipts. And that concludes our closeout report for the Office of the Governor, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any questions? And I don't, Representative Wool.
I'm on a roll here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. 173 total positions, 150 full-time. By comparison, do you know the numbers from the, say, the previous administration?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I don't know compared to the FY19 number, but I can get those for you and get them back to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, the administration had, I'm told they're going to amend it, but they had cut the judiciary's budget, and I was told they cut the legislature's budget for FY21. Is that, and I ask that, I know we're looking at the administration's budget, but they're sort of part of a whole. Am I right that those budgets weren't forwarded as delivered?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, that is correct.
Any further questions on Office of the Governor? Okay. Representative Johnston?
Yes, I probably should know this, but the reduced authority in the Office of Management and Budget, the interagency receipts, is that the same cost that we have in our legislative budget and the same cost the court has in theirs as far as it's different? What is this?
Ms. Cunningham?
Representative Johnston, through the chair, that is not what this reflects. Those are two separate items. I believe this is simply a cleanup, not related to those two.
Cleanup. Okay, thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Johnston and Ms. Cunningham. So that takes us over to the Department of the Fish and Game. And I'd like to invite up Representative Ortiz, staff Liz Harpold, and Alexi Painter. We're seeing a lot of you these days, Mr. Painter. Kind of skinny over there in Ledge Finance these days. And if you could both put yourselves on the record.
Great, thank you. My name is Liz Harpold. I'm staff to Representative Ortiz.
Alexi Pancher, Legislative Finance Division.
All right, the House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Fish and Game recommends that the House Finance Committee accept the Department of Fish and Game's FY21 budget. The numbers only budget with amendment recommendation totals by fund source. 51,491,000 UGF, 14,257,000 DGF, 67,403,000 other funds, 70,126,000 federal funds, for a total of 203,269,000. The unrestricted general fund difference from the FY21 adjusted base to the FY21 House Subcommittee recommended budget is a reduction of 5,900 UGF, which is less than 1% below the FY21 adjusted base. The position count for our recommended budget includes 836 permanent full-time positions, 606 permanent part-time positions, 8 temporary, for a total of 1,450 positions. The governor submitted 13 budget action items that the House Finance Subcommittee discussed and voted on. The subcommittee accepted one of them and rejected 11 of them and amended one of them. The item that the House Finance Subcommittee accepted is a fund source change within the state subsistence research and monitoring section. The item the House Finance Subcommittee accepted after amending was reducing support for the License Modernization and Sport Fisheries Division by 100,000 UGF instead of the originally proposed 250,000 UGF reduction, and this will play into an amendment that I'll speak to in just a little bit. And the items the House Finance Subcommittee rejected are, 8 of them were largely related to a $1.1 million decrement to the Division of Commercial Fisheries. Another item was related to a fund source change within the Division of Wildlife. One item was to reduce travel funding within the boards of fisheries and game, and one item was to reduce funding in the habitat section. The House Finance Subcommittee adopted unanimously the following amendment, adding 94,100 UGF to the Division of Commercial Fisheries Central Region for the Prince William Sound Otolith Program. And that concludes my summary of the Fish and Game Subcommittee actions.
And do we have any questions? Okay, seeing no questions, are you also doing the next? Looks like we've got, I think you're also here for the next one as well, Ms. Harpold. We're now on to the Department of Environmental Conservation, and if we could have Michael Partlow, Legislative Fiscal Analyst, also come up to the table, and if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, Michael Partlow, Legislative Finance.
Ms. Harpold.
Thank you. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Environmental Conservation submits the following recommended operating budget for FY21 to the House Finance Committee. Fund sources and total funding by fund source is 15,471,000 UGF, 25,294,000 DGF, 17,677 in other funds, 24,356,000 in federal funds, for a total of 82,799,000. There is no difference in the UGF used from FY21 adjusted base to the FY21 House Subcommittee budget. Position count includes 485 permanent full-time positions, 0 permanent part-time, and 1 temporary, for a total of 486. The governor submitted 7 items for the committee to review. The subcommittee accepted 3 of these items and rejected 4 of the items. The items the House Finance Subcommittee recommends accepting are to delete an account for position, which was previously funded with SIP receipts, that the scope of the project is no longer there, to add interagency authority to the spill prevention and response, to add federal receipt authority for the Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination Systems Permitting and Compliance Program. Items the House Finance Subcommittee rejected are a fund source change for commercial shellfish testing, the elimination of the dairy program, to reduce authority along with 7 PCNs in spill prevention and response, and a fund source change within the Division of Water Quality Infrastructure Support and Financing. The subcommittee also adopted 2 amendments. One was to add 3,426,000 in Ocean Ranger Fund to restore the Ocean Ranger program by a vote of 6-2. And this is also with understanding that it would not be in play for the 2020 cruise season, but for next year. And that should any legislation come forward to amend this program, any change in funding would be addressed in a fiscal note for that bill. And also the subcommittee adopted intent language requesting the Division of Environmental Health rename the dairy program to dairy safety. And that concludes my summary of the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Representative Sullivan Leonard and then Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. So could you clarify from the subcommittee's amendments their reduction with the Ocean Ranger position? Is that one position at the cost of $342,000? Is that correct? And that's DGF funds, I believe. I'm just trying to figure out if it's one position, two positions. What are we paying for with that amount of money?
Certainly.
Ms. Harpold?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I'm going to talk with Mr. Partlow here for just a moment, and we'll get back to you if that's okay.
We can take a brief at ease.
Yeah.
Okay, House Finance back on record. Ms. Harpold.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I received clarification from Admin Services Director Ruth Kostick that the $3.4 million Ocean Ranger Fund goes as, it serves as a contract, like contract payments. It's not for positions within the department. It's for people who serve the Ocean Ranger program outside of the department.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, a follow-up on the last question. So the Ocean Rangers, it sounds like they are not or were not state employees. They were contractors. Is that the essence of what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct.
Follow-up.
So the subcommittee, notwithstanding essentially the rating of the Ocean Ranger account, voiced an opinion that it be restored as it had been for purposes of an Ocean Ranger program. Is that the essence of it?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that is correct.
Follow up.
The department and the administration, what can you tell us about the reduction of seven positions? Were these unfilled positions in SPAR, or were did they think we just didn't need them, or what is your understanding of that?
Mr. Partlow?
Michael Partlow with Legislative Finance, through the chair, Representative Josephson. My understanding was that five of the positions were unfilled and two were filled, but I may get clarification from DEC. And the purpose of the reduction for these positions had to do with their funding source, which is from the Oil Hazardous Waste Fund that we're drawing down faster than any money is coming into it. So the belief is that that fund would run out of funding by 2024 if these reductions were not made in terms of the positions that are funded with that funding source.
Follow up.
So I think you're talking about the, Mr. Partlow, you're talking about the tax on throughput of the 5 cents per barrel. Is that what you're talking about? That's being depleted. And so was it the department's position that we should just, rather than fixing that problem, just watch programs go away or watch positions go away? Is that sort of what they argue?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, their argument was that at current spending levels, the fund would go down. Any debate as to increased revenue for that fund did not come up.
Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, it says the subcommittee rejected the fund source for commercial shellfish testing. I'm assuming they rejected half of the fund source, the half that was provided by industry, but the half that was provided by the state was doubled. I know that they wanted to do a 50-50 type arrangement, so I'm assuming that the industry side was rejected, but then the state portion would be compensated to meet the same level of funding. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, the action that the subcommittee took was to reject the governor's proposed action item in its entirety, which included the 50% that the state would cover and the 50% in program receipts, therefore bringing it back to how the program has been funded in previous years by the state.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Did you have one? No. Okay. And I believe that's everything, and we will now move on to the Department of Education. I'd like to invite Representative Ortiz staff Caroline Hamp up to the table to join Mr. Partlow. And if you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Caroline Hamp, staff to Representative Ortiz. Going over the budget subcommittee for the Department of Education Early Development, they submit the following in funds: unrestricted general funds, $50,902,100; designated general funds, $25,669,600; other funds, $36,425,000; federal funds, $245,512,100; for a total of $358,508,800. Compared to adjusted base, the subcommittee budget totals are a decrease of 8.2, but in terms of just UGF, it's an increase of 12.2. The discrepancy can be found primarily in the actions taken regarding the public school trust fund, which I'll describe later. The total fund difference with the governor budget from the subcommittee budget are fairly similar, a 0.2 increase total and 1.1 increase of UGF. The position summary is also listed there with total positions of 284. The actions that the subcommittee took out of the 19 governor budget action items, the subcommittee adopted 16 of those. Some of the larger ones that we should highlight are outsourcing the federal family education loan program servicing, which eliminated six positions and was a decrement of $586,300 in interagency receipts. They also replaced the funding source for Mount Edgecombe Boarding School from the Public School Trust Fund to the General Fund, and transferred the Public School Trust Fund to the Language Section. The subcommittee also added two residential programs for North Slope Borough School District and Lower Yukon School District with an increment of $900,200. Of the governor's proposed budget action items, the subcommittee rejected three of those, which were the authority for the State Board of Education to hold additional in-person meetings, transferring Parents as Teachers program to the Department of Health and Social Services, and eliminating the online with libraries video conferencing system. Along with that, the subcommittee adopted one member amendment that was also regarding online with libraries. It was intent language, and it asked the department to evaluate cost efficiency measures for the OWL program, considering use of alternative equipment for the video conferencing system, evaluating implications of eliminating that service, and preparing a report to summarize those results to the legislature. Lastly, the subcommittee had a discussion that I'd like to bring to the attention of Finance Committee. Although the subcommittee did not take any formal action on this, the subcommittee hopes that the House Finance will evaluate the importance of the $6 million in pre-K grants that are no longer allocated, and the loss of service without those funds. And that is the conclusion of my report.
Thank you, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, is it staff's belief, if you know, that this was left, that is, the pre-K grant was left unfunded because of Senate Bill 6 and some grander plan, or?
It was just two-year funding for the pre-K grants. I see. And the year ended this past year.
And
follow-up?
follow-up as an educational opportunity for me. The second page, transition of the public school trust fund to the language section. What is the impact of that?
Mostly it's for efficiency and logistics. The public school trust fund, the way it was managed, it was through the Department of Revenue, I believe, and every time the Department of Education or Mount Edgecombe School would have to make a transaction, it was cumbersome, and they'd have to coordinate with revenue, and they couldn't just do like a one-time draw for what they needed. It was frequent interaction.
Thank you.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify, and I think I came up with the answer while looking at it, but the Subcommittee for Education rejected the transfer of parents as teachers to Department of Health and Social Services, but the Subcommittee on Health and Social Services accepted the transfer from the Department of Education. So I guess there's a bit of a standoff, and I don't know what happens there. I don't know who has the bigger budget or whatever.
Representative Ortiz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I wouldn't describe it as a standoff that's coming up. I'm sure that, you know, that's our decision to make on the full Finance Committee, and we'll work it out. I'm sure that we can work it out. And one of the members on the committee who brought forward the idea that we should reject the transfer was adamant about not adamant, but was concerned about once it was transferred over to Health and Human Services, there was a $40,000 fee associated with, you know, that the department added to the administration of that program under Health and Human Services, and when DEED controlled the Parents as Teachers program, there wasn't the $40,000 fee. So that was just one thing. And then there's a general notion that the delivery of this educational program might be better suited under go back to being a part of the Department of Education. So let's kind of summarize it, but we'll work it out.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Bartlow, and thank you, Ms. Hemp. So next we'll move over to the Department of Public Safety, and I'd like to invite Representative LeBond's Chief of Staff, Joe Burns, up to the table, as well as Mr. Bartlow. And if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, Michael Bartlow, Legislative Finance.
For the record, Joe Burns, staff to represent LeBond. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Public Safety held 7 meetings and took action on the governor's fiscal year 2021 budget request. The subcommittee recommendation had funding from the following sources. In unrestricted general funds, $179,254,900. In designated general funds, $8,737,900. In other funds, $13,209,500. In federal funds, $27,671,300 for a total of $228,873,600. The subcommittee's recommendations were a reduction of $2,764,000 in unrestricted general fund spending below the department's FY21 governor's request, which is a 1.2% decrease. And this was a $9,821,000 increase in UGF from the FY21 adjusted base. The subcommittee recommended accepting the governor's FY2021 request with the following highlights and changes. Adding the governor's requested 15 state troopers and support positions to increase staffing and operational capacity in rural areas, with new state troopers posted in Ambler, Anchor Point, Bethel, Dillingham, Ammonick, Glen Allen, Kotzebue, Nome, St. Mary's, St. Michael's, and Unicleet, while backing out $1,480,000
of UGF in one-time startup costs associated with the 15 state troopers to be covered by the department with the anticipated delay in recruitment and hiring of all the new positions. To restoring $1 million of funding for the Village Public Safety Officer grantees to partially meet the recommendations of the VPSO Working Group and adding intent language that the department worked to implement the recommendations of the working group. Three, restoring $250,000 in UGF for the Alaska Wing Civil Air Patrol, allowing the state to leverage additional resources to support search and rescue efforts in the form of volunteer hours, and also adding intent language to strengthen the liaison between the state and the Civil Air Patrol. And four, denying the requested authority in the Alaska State Trooper appropriation to reduce vacancy, saving $2,733,900 in UGF, and adding intent language for the department to fill vacant positions and reduce overtime costs to better manage within the authorized budget. Are there any questions?
Any questions regarding public safety? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So regarding the Civil Air Patrol, leveraging volunteer hours with $250,000, can you explain to me, please, how $250,000 isn't paying for volunteer hours? It seems like if you're going to volunteer, you don't need $250,000 to volunteer. That would be a paid position.
Mr. Burns?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter. So the state support for the Civil Air Patrol that goes to items like hangar and maintenance costs and pilot and aircraft readiness. So while the Civil Air Patrol is made up of volunteers, some of those other costs, those overhead costs, do require funding from a source. And historically, the state has provided state support.
Thank you.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where'd it go? Establishing a new allocation within the Alaska State Troopers appropriation for training academy recruit salaries to provide greater transparency. Is it recruit salary? Is that just a salary for someone who's just starting in the department, or is that a bonus to enhance someone to come work for the department?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf. So as the department is structured now, recruits are paid out of the detachments allocation and any of the excess funding inside the detachments allocation. So the restructure adds a new allocation that's just for recruit salaries to show that those recruits, while they're inside at the Law Enforcement Training Academy in Sitka, that those recruits are paid out of a different set of funds.
Follow up. So this is only while they're at the academy, not when they're actually in the field?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question with regard to the $1 million UGF for the VPSO grantees. Can you go into greater detail on that for what the funds would be used for, and presently what other funds are being used for VPSO?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard. So it would just be additional funding for the grantees. The FY21 adjusted base figure for the VPSO program is $11,058,100. So this would just be another additional $1 million for the VPSO grantees. Inside the VPSO working group recommendations, they wanted to restore funding to the FY18 levels, which would bring back the $3 million that was vetoed from the governor's budget last year. This just restores $1 million of that.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
Okay, thank you for that information. And then when we look at the VPSO program, again, I had asked about other funding sources then for VPSO.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, are you referring to other funding sources like federal or local? So not prepared to speak on that specifically. That would be probably a better question for the department. The funding from the state that goes towards positions, and then those are granted out to the organizations, the grantee organizations that have the VPSOs. But I can reach out to the department and have them follow up with you.
Okay, and then follow up, Mr. Follow Chairman, up. If I could. Do you know presently how many VPSO positions we have open around the state, and how many are usual then for our rural areas?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I'd have to get back to you on the exact numbers.
Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was there discussion in the subcommittee level? I don't see any reflection of it. I believe the department came forward with a 700,000 plus increment suggestion in order to promote consolidation of 911 dispatch services in the Anchorage area. Was there any discussion about that request? Am I missing something here?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there was a little discussion about that. The department informed us that this was the second phase of the consolidation to create that emergency communication center in Anchorage, that there was previous capital funding to build out the facility, so this was the fund positions there. The department informed us that there was additional capabilities that would come through the consolidation and use of the enhanced 911. There was one note of concern that was brought up by a member regarding making sure that the department was working with the telecom utilities to make sure that everything was prepared and ready, but there was no other concerns that were raised in the subcommittee beyond that.
So, just to follow up?
Follow up.
So, I assume then that request for an additional 700,000, I can't remember the exact figure, falls within the UGF appropriation of 8,737,000?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, are you asking how much was funded from UGF for that item?
Yeah, that item, is that tied into all UGF dollars?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, that is correct. It was 872,800 in general fund dollars.
872?
Correct.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Johnston?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. This department has a large number of new employees that will need to be trained. In the subcommittee, did you spend time on how long it takes to recruit and put in place all these new employees? I gather that might be why a change in the vacancy factor, but have you also just accounted for the fact that this might not be something that will be fulfilled in the year's budget?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston. So that was one of the considerations when the decision was made to back out the one-time cost for the troopers. The thought process was that a lot of these positions would take time to fill, and that by backing out those one-time costs, those one-time costs could be covered through the time that it takes to fill those new positions. The department did tell us that they believe they can fill these positions relatively quickly.
Thank you.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Did the VPSO program lapse money last year, and if so, how much?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, if you give me 1 second, I can pull up the figures.
Mr. Partlow? Sure, brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record. Mr. Burns.
Mr. Chair, to Representative Merrick, so the department has informed me that close to $3.6 million lapsed in FY19. However, I would note that grantees have raised concerns about how the program is administered and how funding has been distributed. And then to answer a previous question, the department has informed me that they have currently 33 VPSOs and then 8 hired that are untrained at the moment. They're going through a training process. However, it's not like state positions are not vacant PCNs that we can track. It's just how funding is dispersed to the grantees.
Follow up.
Do we know how much? So we don't know how much those 8 VPSOs will cost.
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, we can get back to you on that.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Just as a point, I would expect that 8 VPSOs are less than $3.6 million, so I don't see the need for $1 million additional at this point.
Representative Johnston?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. And I'm not quite, this might be hard for you to answer because you're not the department, but you were spending time on the department budget. Of that, the funding that was lapsed, was there a concern as far as that the lapsed funding, the contractors had wanted to use the lapsed funding for recruitment and for housing, and it was not, it was, the department felt that that was not our appropriate use of the funds or something of that sort?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, it's probably a better question for someone that sat on the VPSO working group or for the department. The VPSO working group members, the grantees that participated, they did raise concerns about how the funds were being distributed and the purposes that they had requested the funds for. And how willing the department was to disperse those funds for those purposes.
Okay, thank you. So just a follow-up, not being part of the working group and not being part of this subcommittee, I guess I would want to make sure that we're not comparing apples and oranges, because it might be, I'm always interested in unfilled positions and not funding them if they're not going to be filled, but I don't quite know maybe the needs for funds and if we're not meeting the needs of rural Alaska because of a disagreement on what the program should look like, I would have concerns.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Mr. Chairman, if I could we please have the DPS commissioner maybe address some of these questions if we could have her at the table? We're kind of talking in circles around her and she's right here. Maybe she could at least assist us with some of these questions.
Commissioner Price.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Amanda Price, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. Specifically, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I would put forward for the consumption of the committee that at the close of the second quarter in fiscal year 20, the program had expended 35.9% of the appropriation. We would expect 50% of the appropriation at 50% of the year to be expended. The department has also provided a comprehensive response to the working group findings and recommendations. The department's response included a lot of historical documentation over the last 40 years that brought up issues as they relate to retention recruitment issues that plague the program. There have been a number of white papers and concept papers put forward over the last 40 years addressing the issues that have plagued the program since its inception. The department is currently in process of adopting one of the recommendations of the working group as soon as possible, which is transferring the positions administratively that govern the program to the Department of Commerce.
Any further questions or comments? Thank Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, I guess I just would say, as someone who's spent fair amount of time in rural Alaska and lived in two different communities. There are 230 villages. A minority of them are serviced with law enforcement. Whatever the solution is, and I frankly have not been able to keep up with all the impressive media coverage. It's won press awards and the like. It's going to take a lot of resources. There's no getting around that. Is that a fair statement?
Representative Josephson through the chair, yes.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure this question should go to you, Ms. Price, but Representative Josephson mentioned the number of communities, and it was mentioned there's 33 VPSOs with eight more coming on, maybe. How many communities have a VPO, I guess a village police officer, which isn't, as I understand, under the Department of Public Safety, is that correct?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, you are correct. There is there's a regulation that requires communities to notify the Alaska Police Standards Council, which is part of the Department of Public Safety, when a VPO has been hired. That is a regulation and not codified. We are attempting to correct that. So we have a list of VPOs from communities that have provided that information to us, and I do have that list, but off the top of my head, I can't tell you what the number is, sir. I can get it to you.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it on the range of 33 similar VPSOs, or is it 66, or do you know off the top? I mean, is it about the same, or is it a lot more or a lot less?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, if I recall correctly, the number that we have sort of regulated through the Police Standards Council is about 45.
Thank you.
I guess on the track of how many communities there were, I think Representative Josephson, you said there were around 230. I know there's a number floating around there. About what number, what percentage of villages don't have any public safety whatsoever, whether that's a VPSO or VPO or a tribal police officer, a TPO?
Mr. Chairman, I think that question, which has been circulated through media, is somewhat confusing to answer because the question is there a peace or police officer located in the village? That question is a bit misleading because simply because there's not somebody in the village doesn't mean that there's not public safety provided to the village from a hub community. And in fact, the working group's recommendations include adopting the hub and spoke model that the Alaska State Troopers currently use, which means having a VPSO in a community providing services to surrounding communities. So that is a model that has worked and as effectively as we can do in our geographic constraints and employment and personnel constraints that we face. There are a large number of communities that don't have a peace or police officer located in the community.
Further questions, comments? Representative Knopp and then Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, going back to Rep. Josephson's question and more on to Representative Merrick's point. So Rep. Josephson asked about additional resources going to be needed to fix this problem. So if we're talking financial resources, you stated that there's a lot of grant funds that were never utilized. So I would think that maybe them resources were available. Are we talking other types of resources to fix these problems, or is it financial resources we're referring to here?
Representative Knopp, through the chair, it's a very comprehensive need in rural Alaska, as many as all of you around this table know. There's housing challenges, there's infrastructure challenges, there's holding facility challenges. Specific to the Village Public Safety Officer Program, certainly we all share the common goal of improving public safety by increasing the number of officers, whether it's peace officer or police officer, available to serve our communities. The challenges that plague the Village Public Safety Officer Program, as I mentioned, are historic and have not been corrected, though many, many years of work has gone into attempting to do so. I would question, one of the questions I would like to see the answer to is instead of addressing the Department of Public Safety and what the department is doing regarding the Village Public Safety Officer Program, get a comprehensive report from each of the 10 grantees on what their recruitment requests have been, what their recruitment actions have been, how many times, if any, they've been in the villages that they provide service to doing recruitment efforts. I understand that the recruitment efforts, which have been funded, I know there's been some question about that in FY20, recruitment efforts were funded to every single grantee that requested recruitment funding. Those recruitment dollars have gone to creation of videos that are located on social media as well as LinkedIn advertising. This is work that the Department of Public Safety does and certainly addresses as impactful in our ability to recruit. However, due to the functional and historic creation of the program, looking to hire from a community for a community, I do have questions about whether those recruitment efforts are effective in meeting the goals of the program.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, can you just quickly summarize in terms of fulfilling the mission of public safety, what the difference would be in the ability of a VPO versus a VPSO in promoting public safety?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, a VPO is a peace officer and a village police officer is a police officer, two different statutory definitions. I have my Police Standards Council chair here if you would like to have a comprehensive answer from him. But one of the challenges with the program is related to this question itself, because peace officers and or police officers working for a non-police agency are challenged with liability insurance, use of force compliance, other such challenges and concerns. This is a direct question that relates to a village public safety officer's ability to carry a weapon, which statutorily there is capacity for VPSOs to carry a weapon, but currently none do so because of liability concerns. Having a nonprofit employ essentially a police force is one of the structural challenges with the program. In addition, sir, if I might, because they are peace officers and not police officers, having a village public safety officer present in any community does not negate the need for an Alaska State Trooper to respond. A village public safety officer is a supplement, not a replacement for an Alaska State Trooper.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That just brought up a point. Living in the community of Fairbanks, I see a lot more cars driving around saying VPSO on them than I used to. And I asked some questions and people said, for example, the community of Nanana is now served by VPSO, where in the past it was a trooper who was monitored or manned by troopers. So you just said that the two are not, they're not the same. does that mean that there wasn't enough troopers to keep someone in Nanana or in that area, and therefore VPSO has been brought in? Or I don't understand how that works exactly.
Representative Wool, through the chair, good question. The community of Nanana does in fact have a trooper present, Trooper Hessler. He's on paternity leave, so that's why he hasn't been physically present. But the community of Nanana has both a trooper and a village public safety officer present. A village public safety officer has a different set of hiring and background requirements, as they do training requirements. That means to the department that the village public safety officer is not best suited to complete complex felony investigations. The historic generation of the village public safety officer was to have a first responder that was trained in fire prevention, law enforcement being one of the components, and they were meant to be a gap until an Alaska State Trooper was present. So the grantees themselves actually work with the communities, and there's a number of requirements that a community has to demonstrate before the grantee will select to place a village public safety officer in those communities. And that decision is solely lying with the grantee and not with the Department of Public Safety on which communities the village public safety officer goes to.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question regarding the tribal police officer. Are they still underneath the Police Standards Council? And what is the funding source for a tribal police officer?
Representative Carpenter, through the chair, Police Standards Council, tribal police officers. I might ask for my lifeline executive director Griffiths to step up. The funding for tribal police officers does not come through the state of Alaska. Primarily they are through the federal Department of Justice through COPS grant funding. It's direct to tribes. And tribal police officers are certified. Nope. Village police officers are certified through the Police Standards Council. Tribal police officers are not certified through the Police Standards Council. Thumbs up. I got it.
Good lifeline.
Further questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Deeper dives.
So next up, we will have the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and I'd like to invite Representative LeBond's staff and Rickers up to join Mr. Partlow. And if you could also put yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, Ann Rickers, staff to Representative LeBond. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs submits the following recommended operating budget for fiscal year 21 to the House Finance Committee. $22.7 million in unrestricted general funds, $178,000 in designated general funds, $9.7 million in other funds, and $32.9 million in federal funds, for a total of $65.6 million. This is an overall reduction of $715,900 unrestricted general funds, which is 3.1% below the fiscal year 21 adjusted base. The subcommittee accepted all of the governor's action items, including these highlights: the transfer in of the Alaska Land Mobile Radio and the Alaska Satellite Telecommunication System from the Department of Administration, deleted one full-time administrative position, and reduced authority to janitorial contract savings and armory divestiture. Thank you. We are available for questions.
Any questions on Department of Military and Veterans Affairs? Seeing none, I think you're also doing the Department of Revenues subcommittee report.
Thank you. For the record, Ann Rickers, staff to Representative Lamont. The House Finance Budget Subcommittee for the Department of Revenue submits the following recommended operating budget for fiscal year 21 to the House Finance Committee: $27.3 million in unrestricted general funds, $2.6 million in designated general funds, $266.2 million in other funds, and $79.9 million in federal funds, for a total of $376.1 million. This proposal matches the governor's UGF request, which is 7% above fiscal year 21 adjusted base. The subcommittee accepted all of the governor's budget action items, including these highlights: added funding for the Tax Revenue Management System, also known as TRIMS, maintenance and support costs, an increment of $2.2 million UGF, reduced Alaska Retirement Management Board custody and management fees, a decrement of $5 million in other funds, reduced Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation management fees, a decrement of $21 million in permanent fund gross receipts, consolidated the fish tax group into the excise tax group, and deleted a publication specialist position, a decrement of $346,000 UGF, added funding for the long-term care ombudsman's office travel impacting the health and safety of Alaskan seniors, $21,000 UGF. The subcommittee also adopted $2.7 million in authority for an incentive compensation plan to be paid from permanent fund gross receipts for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Thank you. We are available for questions.
Okay. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reduction in $21 million from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation management fees, how is that? Is that simply by bringing management in-house from the Wall Street sources that they've used in the past?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, that was from the elimination of their external investment officer, CIO program, and bringing that in-house.
Follow up. So can I assume that the savings of $21 million also allows for the incentive plan of $2.7 million? Since they're saving by bringing it in-house, the logic is to then create an incentive for those in-house people to retain them and not have them go back to work in Wall Street or various places like that.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer that one. It's just not an offset because they're saving money in one area. It's also to retain and reward good performance in a critical area of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. A very competitive world that large investment houses and Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Their board of directors had requested this headroom to pay out performance bonuses if they're earned, and it's up to the executive director and the board of directors to measure performance and pay out bonuses as they are warranted.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Representative LeBon. And we have heard over the years of that issue, so I'm glad you addressed it as a recommendation, and it looks like there's savings as well from bringing it in-house. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, for Ms. Rickers, the bonus that's being discussed, is this to a state employee, or are they not regarded as state employees because they work for the corporation, or can you describe that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this program is for APFC employees, and the awards would be available to eligible staff contingent on the fund exceeding its short and long-term policy benchmarks.
Follow up.
So essentially there's $2,700,000 that could be awarded to employees that live in largely in Juneau, is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes.
Okay. Follow up?
Follow up.
Is this a new program?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I believe the Board of Trustees first talked about this program in 2017, and this, I believe, was the first fiscal year that they put this program forward in their budget recommendation.
I just am unfamiliar with, I understand the nature of the work and the culture of the work and the competitiveness of holding on to folks. I just am unfamiliar with people who are public employees essentially getting that sort of privilege. I'm not saying it's a bad policy, it just doesn't happen in other agencies. And it sounds like something to dialogue about.
Representative LeBon and then Representative Johnston. Representative
Thank
LeBon.
You, Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Josephson, it's a different world. Investment expertise at that level is so unique. It's the competition for talent at that level is just not nationally. It's almost, you could call it international, to recruit the type of money managers and investment counselors that the Permanent Fund Corporation needs. It's now, what, a $68 billion fund. And the expertise needs to be recruited and retained. Again, this is headroom. If they don't perform, if they don't meet benchmark expectations, then the bonus money won't be paid. So this headroom, I think, is critical to their long-term ability, not just to recruit, but to retain this type of talent. Thank you.
Representative Johnston and then Wolf.
Actually, just in a follow-up to Representative LeBon, and he said most of what I was going to say. The corporation has been bringing in-house a lot of their investments now, as opposed to having managers manage it where they take off a percentage right off the top. And so we are starting to save money and make more money. So I agree with everything Representative LeBon said. I think everybody in this room wants to grow the fund.
Representative Wool and then Josephson.
I'll cede to Representative Josephson.
Representative Josephson.
So he can follow up.
I'm not necessarily opposed to it, but I'm thinking, for example, of tribal reclaiming and how there's some public employees somewhere that have saved us $100 million. You can make interesting arguments about that. But I do have one question. The other funds, the $266 million, the source of that is the permanent fund itself. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, largely, yes, but there were also other fund sources through the ARM board management fee reduction, including group benefits, PERS trust, teachers retirement, judicial retirement, and National Guard fund.
Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I recall the conversation of years past with Angela Rodell, as far as saving money by bringing it in-house and then using that for a bonus type structure, I remember there may have been some technical issues with how we pay public employees. Is there a parallel? I noticed that the ARM board also is saving management fees to the tune of $5 million. It's probably a very similar issue, a large fund that's being managed in-house. Is there a parallel program, or is this only for the permanent fund investors?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, the subcommittee put forward the amendment for the APFC employees, and there was not an amendment for other managed fund employees.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any further questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you. Okay. Well, if there is nothing else to come before the committee, that closes out today's subcommittee reports. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 18th at 9 a.m. I will repeat, at 9 a.m. And at that meeting, we will continue with our subcommittee closeout reports, and we'll be adjourned at 3:25 p.m. Thank you.